This is the Brickcourt Chambers Centenary Podcast. Hello, I'm Finn Pilbrow, and I'm very pleased to welcome you to this Centenary Podcast series. It's 100 years since what is now Brickcourt Chambers was founded by William Jowett. To mark our 100th birthday, we are bringing together past and present members of Chambers to discuss their experiences in practice, on the bench, and in all sorts of places that a career in law has taken them. Through these conversations, we hope to celebrate past achievements, discuss current issues, and hear opinions on what lies in store in the future. In this fourth programme, I am joined by two greats of Brickcourt's first century. Their respective careers are so rich, varied, and storied that we could discuss hundreds of different subjects. But, in addition, of course, to a little bit of reminiscing and Chambers history, we have chosen to discuss public inquiries, something they both have lots of first-hand experience of. What are they good for? How do they work best? And if we are going to have a COVID inquiry, as it appears we are, how should it be set up? Sir Christopher Clarke joined Chambers in 1970, when it was a mere 49 years old. He quickly established himself as one of the foremost and most sought-after commercial practitioners of the day, taking silk in 1984. He was head of Chambers of Brickcourt for 14 years, from 1990 to 2004. Alongside a thriving practice as a commercial advocate, he found time to be chairman of Combar, a councillor of the International Bar Association, a recorder, and a deputy High Court judge. Famously, for a period of 6 years from 1998 to 2004, he was counsel to the Bloody Sunday inquiry. When finally released from that role, he went to the High Court bench, sitting in the Commercial Court until 2013, and then the Court of Appeal until 2017. Upon his retirement, happily for us, he returned to Brickcourt Chambers as an arbitrator. Nicholas Phillips, the Right Honourable the Lord Phillips of Worth Matravers, was called to the bar in 1962 and moved to Brickcourt Chambers in 1971. Thereafter, his career reads like something from a legal boy's own comic. He took silk in 1978, went to the High Court bench in 1987, the Court of Appeal in 1995, and became a law lord in 1999. And then he really got going, becoming Master of the Rolls and Head of Civil Justice in 2000, and 5 years later, Lord Chief Justice, the first to be head of the English judiciary, following the transfer of that role from the Lord Chancellor. After 3 years as Lord Chief, he went back to being only a law lord and was the last senior law lord. The last because, in that role, he oversaw the creation of the Supreme Court, becoming its inaugural president on the 1st of October 2009. He retired from the Supreme Court in 2012, having the previous year been appointed by the Queen to the Order of the Garter. And again, happily for us, he too decided to return to Brickcourt Chambers on his retirement from the bench. I started by asking Christopher what Chambers was like when he joined.
Well, Chambers was completely different. Firstly, it was in Brick Court, but on three separate floors, but not with all the rooms on one level. It had the brilliant clerk, Burley, who is well known to many, and it had, I can't remember, but 14, 15, 16 in number, with a number of distinguished practitioners, but was really completely different from the way in which Chambers are now.
It certainly was, and it had a very wide variety of trades going on in this building. There was a gentleman called Raphael Valls, who had a speciality in advising Spaniards on English law, and this managed to keep him in style, so that he changed his Rolls-Royce, I think, every 3 years. I think he gave one of his old ones to Burley. The head of Chambers practiced crime on the Welsh Circuit, and I think he and Robert Gatehouse were the only two silks in Chambers.
When I first came, having been a pupil somewhere else, I was sitting in the clerk's room and I heard one of the junior clerks on the telephone and he'd said, "Yes, Your Royal Highness, I'll see whether he's in." And I thought to myself, this is the right set of chambers to come. And it was the Duke of Windsor who wanted some advice from Raphael Valls.
I believe famously Peregrine Simon convinced Jonathan Hurst that he'd been instructed by the palace.
Yes.
But that was just perhaps the prank that could happen when Chambers was slightly smaller than it is now.
I can remember the prank because Jonathan came down into the clerk's room and was rubbing his shoes against his calf sort of shining them up a bit. And we all said, oh, Jonathan, where are you going? I couldn't possibly say where I'm going. Oh, really? Okay. And apparently he went as far as Clarence House. And the doors were open and he said, well, I've come to see Her Majesty. And they told him he'd been fooled.
So, Nicholas, how did you end up at Brick Court?
End up's the right word because I didn't start there. And I was going to ask Christopher how he got a pupillage because things were a little different there. So far as I was concerned, I was pretty laid back and hadn't thought about my pupillage. And I was studying my last year to get my bar finals. And in those days in the Middle Temple, you had to eat 36 dinners, ostensibly to talk to barristers. But in fact, you only talked to other students. You never saw a barrister. But on one occasion, two barristers came in to have dinner and I was sitting with them and got talking to them. And I told them I'd done national service in the Navy. And one said, oh, well, I practice in Admiralty Chambers. Why don't you come and do a pupillage with me? And that was Barry Sheen, who later became the Admiralty Judge. And so I said, well, I'd never heard of Admiralty Chambers. So I went and looked him up, saw he's in court quite often. So I said, well, yes, thank you very much. And Christopher, how was your experience?
Well, I'm always embarrassed because the difficulties that people have getting pupillages now are so marked that I feel almost embarrassed in answering this sort of question. But in fact, I used to be taught by the man who was to become my pupil master, criminal law on Saturdays at university, where he came presumably to make a bob or two to keep going. And he was kind enough to say, if you're thinking of coming to the bar, as I certainly was then, would you like to be my pupil? And of course, life was completely different in those days. Unless you got a scholarship from the inn, you didn't get any money from chambers. Pupil masters could take more than one pupil. I think John Phillips had up to three. And you were supposed to pay your pupil master 100 guineas. And I remember saying to my pupil master, who better be nameless, I really think I should pay you the 100 guineas. And he said, this was not in Brick Court. We don't do that in these chambers. That was very kind of you to offer. And I said, well, I think I ought to pay you because the inn gave me a scholarship for that purpose. Ah, oh, could you make the cheque payable to my wife?
And so what did you cut your teeth on in the early days?
Well, after pupillage in Admiralty Chambers, I was offered a place and accepted. And the work was fun. It was all about what went wrong at sea. There was very little law involved. A lot of salvage arbitrations and occasional collision action, which was much more fun. But these are all about what happened. There wasn't much work for a junior to start with, but sometimes you'd get taken on as a second junior.
Because, I mean, the experience perhaps of junior practitioners these days in big commercial sets is that you may spend years before you're actually on your feet and you may struggle to get experience. Were you on your feet regularly at that stage?
Not in Admiralty, but I'd taken the precaution of doing a few months with a firm of solicitors before I went into chambers. You weren't allowed to be paid, but you were allowed to do this. And they had a client who sent them a whole host of running down cases. These were prosecutions in the magistrate's court for careless driving. And I was instructed frequently by then to go and appear for the defendant. They weren't interested in getting their client off. What they wanted was a good note of the evidence for the civil proceedings that would follow. So when I wasn't doing something more important, I found myself quite often in the magistrate's court.
And Christopher, you...
Yes. The 1970s were, of course, before civil commercial litigation really took off. And one did have the benefit of actually appearing in court, either in undefended divorces. I remember there was a contest as to how few questions you could ask and get a divorce. I think the answer is five. Winding up petitions. Appearing in the magistrate's courts and also in the civil courts with road traffic accidents, usually according to the evidence, collisions between two stationary vehicles. And then with the introduction of industrial tribunals, a whole new raft of stuff took off.
When you talk about civil commercial litigation taking off,
yes.
I mean, if you think of the practice of your average commercial junior these days, they may well find themselves as the second or third or even fourth junior in a large, long-running piece of litigation. And that is a change in the nature of commercial litigation. Why has it happened? How has it happened? And is it a good thing?
Well, commercial litigation, of course, has got hugely heavy. In the days when I started, the judge would come into court. He might have read the pleadings, he might have read some experts' reports, but he wouldn't have read anything else. The case was opened and documents were read to him. Sometimes cynics would say it was the first time that counsel had read them. The witnesses gave evidence viva voce. There were no written submissions. I mean, the skeleton argument, originally known as the suicide note, wasn't introduced until much later. And everything went at a fairly gentle pace.
One of the reasons for this, maybe the main reason, is that you now have electronic communication. Mm. When we started, there was no way of copying a document except carbon paper or a machine that you had to turn by hand that printed out copies physically. And so when you went to court, you usually carried all the papers in the case in a slim briefcase. You now have an absolute morass of communications, mostly electronic, very hard to digest, and these create litigation that runs for a week.
From the judge's point of view, has that made the job more enjoyable or less enjoyable?
Much worse. Mm. Hideous. In the old days, as Christopher said, judges very rarely read anything beforehand. In fact, it was considered rather bad form or improper to do so because you might form a preliminary view before you'd heard from counsel. So judges would read nothing in advance. The case would proceed quite slowly, in particular because of the ponderous way in which authorities were referred to. The judge hadn't read them in advance either. And then the reply would be the time for the judge to prepare his extemporary judgment. And so you'd know when you'd see him switch off as you started your reply. And when you finished it, he would then deliver an elegant extemporary judgment. So he had very little reserved judgments to occupy him or distract him from the golf course in the vacations.
Compare and contrast, I have just done an arbitration which was brilliantly argued and extremely well assembled, but each side's final submissions had more than 1,900 hyperlinked footnotes. A great achievement on their part, but a considerable strain on that of the recipient.
Yes, the introduction of email and the electronic communication has changed also the nature of the working relationship. Mm. I mean, I imagine when you started, you didn't receive an email from a solicitor at 8 o'clock in the evening who expected you to respond there and then. The nature of the relationship between the bar and the solicitor profession would have been very different.
Absolutely. Your instructions came down wrapped in red tape if they were in an ordinary civil case. And I remember my clerk in my first chambers reprimanding me for returning them too quickly because it would look as though I wasn't sufficiently busy. It was unheard of, really, for counsel to return anything within 7 days.
I mean, if you think a chambers now, you know, has a marketing director and a director of operations and a senior, you know, teams of senior clerks.
That was misconduct when we started at the bar.
To put it mildly, when we started the bar, you were not allowed to have barrister on your visiting card because that would be considered touting.
Yes. And also one of the wonders in those days was that one actually saw people in chambers. If you wander around chambers, there are people there, but there are a lot of people who are not there because perfectly understandably they're working from home. But in those days, everybody worked in chambers. You could even find somebody at tea time.
And you worked, when I started, the normal dress was black jacket and striped trousers.
Yes.
Some relaxation, you were allowed to have a dark suit. And when you went across to court, you needed to have your bowler hat on your head in order to raise it to judges who were passing, who would raise their bowler hats in return, except for Mr. Justice Diplock, who wore a top hat.
And there was a chambers notebook in which Burley would write messages to people, some of which were somewhat intemperate. It would say, "Mr. X, you are now 2 weeks later than you said you would be with something or other. What is happening?" So all your peccadilloes were revealed to everyone.
This was there for everyone to look at, and that everyone was expected to look
yes,
at it.
It's rather interesting.
To see what was directed at them. But, I mean, Burley was a wonderful man. I was very fond of him.
Yeah.
But he did think it was his duty, really, to protect members of chambers from any untoward eventualities. When I told him I was going to get married to a French girl, he looked at me in dismay and said, "Mr. Phillips, sir, if you've got a good relationship, don't spoil it by getting married." But I think I see time's getting a bit short. We might move
yes.
on to the other topic,
yes.
In which we both have some
yes.
not inconsiderable experience, and that's public inquiries.
Absolutely. And that's, well, let's start with that, Nicholas. You tell me, I mean, if you tell us, each of us, the public inquiries you've been in, and that will set out the groundwork for your experience then to tell us how they should be done better.
Yes. Well, in my first 10 years in Admiralty Chambers, before I switched to brick court. I did quite a lot of inquiries, but these were what were called wreck inquiries under the Merchant Shipping Act into shipping casualties.
And Christopher, we've mentioned it already.
I'm afraid only one. I mean, the first inquiry I was in was the Crown Agents Inquiry. The second inquiry that I was in was the Summerland Fire Inquiry. There was a sort of pleasure dome in Douglas in the Isle of Man, which burnt down, and it was the biggest loss of life in peacetime at the time, and I think possibly still. And there was an inquiry into the causes of that, which took place in the Isle of Man, to which one commuted, and completed really quite swiftly, about sort of a mere 49 days.
That is, I think, something that both Christopher and I learnt about inquiries the hard way, which was that they tend to go on much longer than anyone anticipates to start with. My big inquiry, which started almost at the same time as Christopher's, was into BSE, or mad cow disease. And the terms of reference were to look at government conduct in relation to the outbreak of mad cow disease to see what lessons could be learnt. And my terms of reference were to report within a year. Well, it took me 3 years to conduct that inquiry. I don't know whether there's a time limit on the Bloody Sunday inquiry.
No, there wasn't a time limit on the Bloody Sunday. I mean, I can bore for the United Kingdom on the Bloody Sunday inquiry, but it took a very long... I mean, in the end, from start to finish, it took about 10 years.
Look at the inquiries that are going on now. There's Grenfell Towers. Yeah. This was a tragic event when a block of flats burnt down, but that inquiry's been running for how long now? 2 years? Mm. There's an inquiry into child abuse, I think, that's been running for a very long time. There's an inquiry into contaminated blood,
yep,
which again has been running for over a year. These inquiries take a very long time, and most of them are inquiries in which the tribunal will, if appropriate, find people at fault. And the minute you say that people are going to be at risk of being found at fault, you inhibit getting at the truth, because any witness who feels vulnerable will be doing his best to clear his own yardarm rather than to help the inquiry find out what actually happened.
And he will do his best with lawyers. If he thinks that he's going to be criticised, he says, well, I'm entitled to be represented, and the whole thing becomes an enormous scenario. I mean, funnily enough, the body which inquires into air accidents, the Air Accident Board, they seem to avoid this problem. I think everybody in the industry realises the importance of their work for public safety and doesn't take the attitude, well, we're not going to say anything because we might be criticised.
But that picks up Nicholas's point. They're not there to find fault. They're there to learn lessons for future travel. Perhaps that makes it easier.
It's very understandable that the general public and, above all, the media are very anxious to find fault. There's something rather satisfying about finding that somebody is to blame and blaming them.
Yeah.
But the stress on anyone who is exposed to this possibility is very high. I remember one minister who gave evidence at the BSE inquiry telling me much later how stressed he had been. And I had about over 100 ministers or ex-ministers who gave evidence.
We've got a host of problems, but what are the situations where an inquiry is useful? What type of problem are they good for helping with, and how should one set them up to help in that situation?
Well, the most important thing about most inquiries is to find out what went wrong in order to make sure it doesn't go wrong again, to find out what lessons can be learnt from the disaster. And that's obviously true of the inquiry that's going to take place into COVID. But there are, I suspect, a large number of lessons to be learnt from COVID. And I myself think it's very questionable whether it's practical to imagine that one can encompass all of these in a single inquiry. It will go on for, I was tempted to say, decades, and that's not necessarily an exaggeration.
Yeah, yes, I agree with that. I mean, I was thinking of the inquiries that I was referring to. The Crown Agents inquiry was, I think, softly a bit spoken, a waste of time. The Summerland Fire inquiry found that there was no villainy, but it was human fault. The Bloody Sunday inquiry, people take a series of different views, but of course it was appointed shortly before the Good Friday Agreement and was in fact, I like to think, a contributor to the process of reconciliation in Northern Ireland. So although it cost a fortune, did, I think, do some good.
Did the contribution to it doing good in that way, hearing the 1,000 witnesses, probably helped that part of it, the reconciliation, even if it made the inquiry itself unmanageable?
I was told that there was a priest who played a large part in the process that had led up to the Good Friday Agreement, who sat in the audience when Martin McGuinness was giving evidence, and I was asking him the odd question. And he said, if you had told me 4 years ago that Martin McGuinness would be in the Guildhall of largely Protestant-based place being asked questions by an English silk, I would have said, which planet do you live in?
OK, so what are our lessons from the good things and the bad things if one's going to have a COVID inquiry? One of your suggestions, Nick, is it should be multiple inquiries.
Yes. You need, I think, to think very carefully before you start what you want to achieve and how best to do so. And in particular, if the object of the exercise is going to be to find who is responsible rather than to find what lessons you can learn from it, then weigh up very carefully what it's going to cost. Because I think at the moment in our society there's a tremendous desire for attributing blame and vengeance, which can be extremely expensive and is pursued without regard to the expense. And to give a completely different example, the area of criminal justice, with which also, of course, I had some experience, I have seen the length of prison sentences in this country gradually growing and growing. And this is largely, I think, as a result of the intervention of government imposing in some areas minimum sentencing, which changes the whole scale of sentencing. But there's also something of a climate of vengeance. And it's enormously expensive. Putting people in prison is supposed to, first of all, protect the public, then to reform the prisoner, and thirdly, to punish the prisoner. Well, the length of time that people are in prison at the moment is really can only be explained by the desire to punish. It means that there are inadequate resources to reform and to rehabilitate. So it defeats that particular object. And it's enormously expensive. And I think if individuals, when they paid their tax, had a separate prison tax they had to pay, it might rather alter the public's desire for locking people up and throwing away the key.
OK, so we were trying to avoid a desire for vengeance because that is approaching it the wrong way. But does that mean that we've got the wrong people setting up the inquiry? I mean, they're generally set up by the then-current government who is looking to solve a problem it has, whereas what I'm getting from this is a more targeted, focused inquiry on a specific problem will be more effective.
Well, these inquiries are set up, as you say, by the government of the day, really on two bases. One is to deal with public somewhere between disquiet and anger. Not, I think, a wish for vengeance, but a wish that people who are responsible, we find out who is responsible and deal with them in an appropriate way. That's one consideration. The other is that an inquiry can be a way of kicking the can down the road, so that, surprise, surprise, the timing is often affected by developments in the political scene. And it's going to be governments that set them up, because who else is going to pay for them? I agree with Nicholas that there's a difference between an inquiry which is designed to see what lessons are to be learned and an inquiry whose principal function is to decide who is stroke responsible, stroke to blame, stroke to be criticised. Of course, the two slightly coalesce because in finding out what went wrong or what are the lessons to be learned, you necessarily may have to discover who was responsible for it going wrong in the first place and why it went wrong. But there is a distinction between the two. I mean, take COVID. What I would have thought we need to learn from COVID is, was the science correct? There are two questions. What was the science and did the government follow it? But we need to discover what was wrong with our state of preparedness, of what the science accurately told us and what it inaccurately told us, what could have been done earlier and should have been done earlier, and what we should do in the future. Those are the essential questions.
Well, those are the essential questions, you see, but there'll be a relative of somebody who died in a care home who will be saying what happened in this care home was absolutely monstrous. that of itself could be the subject of a single inquiry. And I think what really needs to happen before the terms of reference of any inquiry or inquiries are drawn up is that there should be an inquiry into the nature of the inquiry or inquiries that should be conducted as a result of this really horrific pandemic.
Take a couple of years.
Okay. And so we refer to setting the terms or setting the procedure. I mean, does that change the nature of an inquiry? I mean, obviously setting the terms does, and the procedure, the decision is what procedure to adopt.
Well, all of this is critical. And looking at the Bloody Sunday inquiry, for instance, and indeed my own into BSE, makes me appreciate that there's a critical decision to be taken at the outset, which is the scale with which you are going to investigate. Are you going to look at what happened every minute of a particular episode, or are you going to look at more broadly? And that's a decision, ultimately, for the tribunal, with the assistance of counsel to the tribunal, but it's critically important.
But is it for the tribunal? I mean, because that's a cost-benefit analysis. Yes. In one sense, if we're going to go by minute, we may take 2 years to do it, and it will cost 100 times more. Or
yes, I mean, that is about how you give effect to your terms of reference. I mean, to take an example, part of my report looked at the inside of cows and how they operated. We needn't actually have done that, and I suspect it was probably a mistake to do it. That was just complying with my terms of reference, which were pretty wide. So the terms of reference are important, but so is the approach of the tribunal to answering them.
Well, I agree with that, but it's actually jolly difficult to work out what should be the scope of what you do. I mean, the terms of reference may restrict it, but quite often the terms themselves are expressed in a very general way. To investigate the outbreak of COVID and decide what lessons are to be learned, anything expressed as wide as that can cover almost anything. And of course, the public is interested to know what the government did, what the Prime Minister did, what the then Minister of Health did or didn't, whether what Mr. Cummings said is true, and he keeps on coming out with more things. And another complication for the COVID inquiry is that most inquiries are investigating something that is over and past. But there's a strong prospect. Let's assume that the government were to decide next year or the end of this year to initiate an inquiry. A whole new development may have arisen in relation to COVID if, as and when, there's a surge in the autumn.
Are judges the right people to chair these kind of inquiries? Is there a different approach rather than the judge-led inquiry that we should be thinking about?
It's a bit hard to generalise in relation to inquiries in general, but I think a judge has got a lot of the experience that helps to run an inquiry. There are all sorts of procedural problems which could raise difficulties for somebody who has no experience of the judicial process. For instance, when parties or witnesses are represented by counsel, it's very important to try to restrain the involvement of all these counsel, which can be unhelpful to the overall aim of the inquiry. When I was conducting the BSE inquiry, I said any counsel who wishes to ask a question of any witness must inform the tribunal in advance of what it is they wish to ask. And as I recollect, we didn't have a single application by counsel to ask a witness anything.
I think that may be difficult in relation to COVID. I mean, it's always tempting for judges or former judges to say that judges are just the right people to conduct inquiries. But there is a strong element of truth in that. I mean, if you look at the list of recent inquiries, Scott, Hutton, Moorbick, Saunders, Langstaff, Nicholas, all practitioners, Basil Henriques in relation to the handling of sexual abuse allegations by the
McPherson. Very good example.
And everybody said, very good example, but particularly because everybody said about McPherson, oh, he's a stuffy old fellow. You don't want the leader of a clan to investigate matters like that. And he came out with a report which, of course, said that the Metropolitan Police had institutional racism. So there's much to be said for them. But, I mean, for instance, the Chilcot inquiry. Chilcot was not a judge. He conducted an inquiry really very cheaply about the Iraq War. So I'm not sure whether to the extent to which he had evidential hearings.
You can have an inquiry which is not a public inquiry. but an inquisitorial inquiry. And that's much cheaper and maybe a better vehicle for getting at the truth. Such an inquiry has to be a bit careful about blaming people if they haven't been given the opportunity to defend themselves.
So if you were left the task of designing the COVID inquiry, perhaps you've been presented with the terms of reference, which are please conduct an inquiry into COVID.
Yes.
And you've both stressed the importance of those early decisions of how you set it up, how you structure it. Beyond saying, no thanks, I'd like someone else to do that, what's the answer?
Well, you need probably two others. Doing it on your own is not, I think.
That's the first thing I would say. And when I started the BSc inquiry, I had two assessors, one a senior civil servant and the other an expert in genetics. And almost the first thing I did was to ask that they be made full members of the panel so that I could delegate writing parts of the report to them. It is important to have people with the right expertise. So if you're having an inquiry into COVID, you've got to have somebody who actually understands the science.
The next thing, I would say this, but it doesn't mean that it's not correct, is that you need to select counsel to the inquiry, because a lot may depend on that, and it's undoubtedly more than one. The next thing that you may need to think about is experts commissioned by the inquiry. Now, that is a slight problem in circumstances where what you're inquiring is about the advice given by experts.
Yes. I mean, who are going to be the experts that judge whether the experts gave...
I mean, you're going to need a few fellows of the Royal Society on that basis. You then need to work out, rather along this, who is going to be represented and to what extent. I mean, that again depends on whether what you're dealing with is
fault-finding
or lessons to be learned. If it's lessons to be learned, it may be extremely limited. If it's fault-finding, it may be extremely large. And the next question, leaving aside people who may be criticised, to what extent should victims be represented? I mean, in the Bloody Sunday inquiry, all of the victims, by which I mean the relatives of those who died or those who were wounded, were represented. Some were represented by... counsel represented several victims. We thought was inevitable. I'm bound to say that some of the representation was better than others. I won't say who. You know, if it's going to be said that the Prime Minister said it doesn't matter if a whole lot of grannies die in care homes, he may wish to be represented.
Yeah. Well, I think you've both successfully disqualified yourselves from having to chair this inquiry.
We're disqualified on grounds of age,
yes,
because you need somebody who's going to live well beyond 100 if you're going to start with one of us.
Well, I'd like to say I hope you do both live well beyond 100 so that we can be having another chat in...
We'll talk about how it went in
exactly.
10 years' time.
We look forward to the follow-up podcast in 10 years' time. But until then, thank you both very much.
Well, not at all. Rather to my surprise, I've enjoyed
it. I've enjoyed it too. It's good to be back in old territory.
Thank you for listening to this programme. You can find out more about this special centenary podcast, the other podcasts in this series, and 100 years of Brickcourt Chambers by visiting our website, brickcourt.co.uk, or by following us on Twitter at @BrickCourt.